Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Poetry and the Bible, Lazarus. Our presenter is Kathy Schwinn, session number SCK 2006-1. Let's listen in.
Okay, well, so the idea today is that we are going to reread, to just refresh our memories, the story of Lazarus from the Bible. And then we're going to look at two poems that deal with sort of retelling revisions of that story. The first one that we'll look really sort of more closely at and spend most of the time on is The Raising of Lazarus by Rilke, and then who is a deceased poet who wrote in German, and I have a book that has the translation in it. So if anybody speaks German and we have any questions that we get into, we can look at that. But we're basically going to work with the translation, realizing that it is indeed a work in translation. And I don't know how you pronounce her first name. I should write this down because it's not on the poem. Thylias? Does anybody know? Anybody with that name?
Sounds right.
I mean, Thylias? I don't really know. Anyway. Thylias Moss is a contemporary African-American female poet, and so then we'll look at her poem, Decision, which is quite a different interpretation. So as we do this, the sort of general questions that I kind of want to return to at the end is sort of keeping track of how are these interpretations changing the story as we know it? How are the characters different? How is the plot being altered? It's mostly character that I want to look at, both Jesus and Lazarus. How are their characters brought and transformed, all that sort of thing, stuff? And then, sort of the end, what do we do with that information? Do we include that as a new sort of truth in our understanding about the story? Is this an artistic interpretation that sort of is nice, but it goes over here outside our sort of biblical or Christian understanding of the story? So, and I should reiterate that the reason that I love to come up here and teach these things is because I really have no idea, you know, the answers to a lot of these questions, and I like to think about them, and it's great to come up here and talk with all of you, because I'm usually in settings where you sort of don't get to insert the faith-based question really into it. So it's really exciting for me to kind of get to talk with people from different faith backgrounds about this sort of stuff. So in line with that, please, like, you know, everybody speak up and, like, let's have a good discussion about this stuff. So, does anyone feel like reading the story of Lazarus? It's John 11, 1 through 44, which is a little bit long, but... and feel free, it's on photocopies, so if there's lines that sort of strike you, things that you sort of didn't remember from...
Then you get all of the copies of
lines! If there's lines, phrases, details that strike you, underline, make notes, whatever.
Maybe we could take turns, because it's divided.
I think that's a good idea. We will be confused if we read based on verses?
No.
No?
It's like in sections, though. No.
Okay. You want to do it by the sections?
Oh, I see what you mean. Oh, yeah, we could go verse by verse.
That might get a little crazy.
Let's take two sections.
Okay, sections. Rick, do you want to start?
I'm going.
Okay. Now, a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent a message to Jesus. Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Accordingly, though Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, after having heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was.
Then, after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now trying to stone you, and are you going there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Those who walk during the day do not stumble, because they see the light of this world. But those who walk at night stumble, because the light is not in them. After saying this, he told them, Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will be all right. Jesus, however, had been speaking about his death, but they thought that he was referring really to sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. For your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, Let us also go, that we may die with him.
When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him. Jesus said to her, Your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world.
When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, The teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary get up quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, Where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, See how he loved him. But some of them said, Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?
Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, Take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, already there's a stench because he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked upward and said, Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here, so that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in cloth. And Jesus said to them, Unbind him and let him go.
Great. That's great news.
What?
Yeah.
So, what strikes you about the story? What things do you notice? What things are weird? What things are odd? What things... whatever. Big things, little things.
Jesus seems kind of moody. Like
Jesus does seem right.
He says, then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. You can kind of hear him say it in a monotone voice, and then all of a sudden later he's weeping.
Okay, so yeah, what kind of verbs we get? Weeping? What other verbs to sort of describe his internal state?
Angry.
Disturbed. We get disturbed twice. Is it clear from the story, I don't really know, why he is all of these things?
Well, presumably it's because Lazarus was somebody who was his friend that they cared deeply about. But there's also a subtext that about belief and disbelief and do people really get it and needing to convince people that he really is on God's mission and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Because we get, even from the very beginning, right, that he knows that this is going to be a proof, like, this is going to be about proof for him.
Right.
That he's going to have to go back, and this is going to be a method of proof. And even though he sort of knows, but it's odd because he sort of knows Lazarus, he's going to bring Lazarus back to life, and yet we get weeping, angry, and disturbed. Yeah.
There's also this moment in the beginning that I never noticed before where he says to them that Lazarus isn't going to die. He said this illness will not lead to death.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like Jesus thought it was one way, and then he's kind of going through this process of realizing that it's another way. And he thought he made a mistake. But like God had it in his head what was going on, but he hadn't really communicated it fully to Jesus.
The lines. Great. Okay. So moody and sort of the language is a little confusing, or the line between. I think you're pointing to the passage where it's like. The difference, he says, sleep and death, and there's the confusion, right?
No, I mean,
or right before?
Earlier, when they say that Lazarus is ill, and he says this illness is not like death.
It's a different kind of illness.
It's a theological statement, though, not necessarily a physical death.
Okay. But there's still...
He says at least God's glory, which then with this resurrection, it's, bring the believers.
But certainly if you're a disciple at this point, you're probably a little bit like, catching the lingo here, Jesus, or is it sleep? Is
it
death? Is this illness that leads to whatever?
And in verse 6, he stays. That's the
right.
Yeah. So the
yeah. Say more about that.
Wait, he waits 2 days. Sort of make his point. He's gonna sit back and wait. Which there's other parts of scripture where he does that other times too, where he waits.
Okay, so he purposefully waits till Lazarus. Kicks the bucket.
If he wants to make sure he dies,
to make sure. Right. Yeah. Like, right. It's like 6 days later or whatever, he finally gets there. So there's something a little,
And he sounds almost schizophrenic. It's almost like there's two different characters.
Okay. Great. Yes. Okay. So, which kind of goes back to the moodiness, but even more so.
More dramatic than moody.
Yes. More like, I don't know how to. Two sides, I guess. It's battling. Battling personas? Probably mostly because I can't spell schizophrenic. Okay, what else? What else do you notice?
Well, I mean, one of the things I've read that some people think that Jesus is very emotional about this because it is about his death.
Yes, okay, so it's foreshadowing. Yes.
His own death. And, he's in a tomb, Jesus is there 3 days, but he's there 4 days, he's wrapped up in cloths, just like him, Mary and Martha will both be at his tomb, waiting.
Great, so, which calls all of the weeping into question, too, is he really grieving for Lazarus, who he knows is coming back to life, or is he grieving for himself in his own death?
Comes to the human side of Jesus, because he makes a statement that says, you'll never die if you believe in me, it's great. And then he's starting to cry. He's thinking about his own death and his friend's death, and that's totally human, not the God part of him.
Right.
Human pain. Right.
So there's this kind of, in this passage, and I think when we read Rilke's poem, it gets even more into this, that we begin to sort of, and I think this goes with the battling personas, The human and the divine sides of Jesus are sort of a little bit talking back and forth and sort of at odds at certain points in this, because who's he weeping for? Like Jesus the divine would probably be weeping for Lazarus, Jesus the human being is weeping for himself, right? So
I don't believe the other way around too.
The divine would weep for himself.
Weep for others.
Right. Did I say that the other way around?
Well, you said it one way, and I think there's another way of saying it too. That Jesus the Divine would also be weeping for those who are hurting. Not Jesus the Divine weeping for himself. Are you saying?
I think it's Jesus the Divine. Anyway, human versus divine. Yes, that's definitely suggested. And how about the character? Do we get anything really about the character of Lazarus in this?
No.
Not in this time.
Not
in this section. Okay.
Smell
bad. Yeah. Smell. Awesome. Good.
And we know Jesus loves him. So
He's a friend of Jesus.
He's a brother.
Brother.
There's not too many times that's said that Jesus, he was a friend of Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's
important.
Special.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And how about, okay, so who are, besides Lazarus and Jesus, who are the other characters?
Mary and Martha.
Mary, Martha, and who else?
Martha, the crowd.
And then the crowd.
Specifically the people of Judea, right? Or the people definitely in Judea or something.
Yes. It says the Jews from around Bethany.
Right.
And what kind of verb do we get with the crowd? Like what sort of their persona?
The mourners.
Maybe. Mourners, yes. Weeping, sad.
They're also trying to guess what Jesus is up to, you know, why he's crying.
Yeah. That's kind of trying to feel out.
Kind of doing what we're doing here.
Yes, but certainly they're there to mourn, and they're weeping and grieving at some points at least. But you're right, they're curious too.
Well, then maybe I would make them. There's another group, the people of Judea, who had recently stoned him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay.
So there's
they don't like him.
So I can label them the stoners.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay.
Dude.
The middle ground group from the stoners. Like stoners.
Dude.
Jesus just rolled away the stone. Okay.
I'm thinking actually that Jesus takes this huge risk to go back.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thomas
is willing to go.
Yeah,
so maybe there's some fear involved in his return as well. Okay. This is awesome. Obviously, because it's all of these things that you guys are catching are definitely there. They're not completely fleshed out, obviously, because those things
often. We also do these, the disciples, in terms of characters, the disciples are critical because obviously a lot of what this is about is to reinforce the disciples' courage and belief. And even though they don't do much, they're in the background.
They're there.
You know.
Great. Okay, so as I'm going to pass out the raising of Lazarus. Is it John? Wait, tell me your name.
David.
You was the name of one of my brothers. Okay, so as we read this poem, enjoy it. Also, what I'm going to ask is, we'll go through it very slowly, but sort of how is it, which parts of this is it fleshing out? Which parts of it is it ignoring? Who are the characters in the poem? Who is sort of ignored in the poem? Stuff like that.
The raising of Lazarus. Yes, it was necessary for this common sort, since they required signs that screamed, yet he dreamed how for Martha and Mary it would be enough simply to see that he could. But none of them believed. They all said to him, Lord, why come now? And so he went to do the unallowed to peaceful nature. In anger, his eyes almost shut, he asked where the grave was. Tormentedly, it seemed to them, his tears streamed, and they thronged behind him, full of curiosity. Even on the way, he thought it monstrous, an appalling, frivolous experiment, but suddenly a great fire broke out in him, such an argument against their prized distinctions, their death and life, their here and there, that he was enmity in every limb. When he instructed hoarsely, lift the stone. A voice shouted that he must stink by now, for he'd lain there 4 days. But he stood tense, entirely filled with that gesture which rose in him and heavily, so heavily lifted his hand. No hand ever raised itself this slowly, with this much weight, until it stood there, shining in the air. And then it clenched, almost claw-like. For now, he dreaded that all the dead might come rushing back through the section of that tomb where the thing had started to writhe up, larva-like, from its stiff reclining. But then just a single shape stood there, crooked in the daylight, and one witnessed the inexact, vague life again accepted.
So any initial impressions anybody wants to throw out first?
One thing from the beginning that I noticed was he talks about to do the unallowed to peaceful nature. So he's talking about Lazarus's death in this peaceful, natural way versus this, you know, horrible thing that people are weeping over and he stinks. It's much more like he's going against nature, which the Bible doesn't really talk about.
So peaceful nature becomes the death, and it's something that he is going to go against.
Yeah.
So instead of where this is clearly a miracle that we have going on, like miracle sort of turns into almost a violation. Like he's it's going to be like a violent kind of procedure.
It's almost giving the connotation that he's doing something he shouldn't be doing versus where there's people begging to save him in the Bible.
Right. It does bring up, like, is this really a good idea? You know, we're totally, at some level, he's totally interrupting the sort of natural flow of life. Okay, what else?
And also a similarity is that this poem really stresses the fact that Jesus wants to just show that he can.
Yes.
That's one of the most important things. And
great.
Like, even maybe more important than bringing his friend back to life.
Yeah, proof becomes very important.
He sounds irritated that he has to prove it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's willing to, but it was necessary for this common sort.
Okay, yeah.
Since they required signs. Signs that screamed.
Yeah, especially that phrase that you emphasized there, common sort, right? I mean, that's not a phrase used with, like, a group that you are loving and feeling tender towards, right?
Well, is it common sort, or is it? I mean, I understand that's how this poem made, but this is the gang who stoned him, right? So
I think he's talking about
Mary and Martha.
Mary and Martha, and the disciples, and
hell for Mary and Martha. It would be enough simply to see that he could. Like, if you could just see that I can do this, isn't that enough? But instead, you're screaming for proof, and that was. I'm reading that he was
disappointed. For the crowd.
I think you're both right. I mean, I think it's for everyone. Mary, Martha, the crowd, who consists both of... I think the most of the crowd that we're talking about are the mourners. I think the stoners, if I'm correct, maybe I'm incorrect, are more in the background. Like, we were a little bit freaked out coming back because the stoners were there. But it seems like in this scene, we have the stoners. Stoners are back there. But in this scene, we're mostly dealing with the disciples, Mary, Martha, and the crowd of mourners. And then sort of all of those together maybe are the...
So when it says on verse 36...
I'm just
trying to make it straight.
Yeah.
On verse 36, so the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why I'm making, and the only mention of either Martha or the disciples, at least in the rest of this, is to get Martha to move the stone away. So that's why I was wondering, I thought it was more about for them.
The crowd.
Right.
Yeah.
Say if you go to verse 18, then I'm not sure if that's referring to the same people. It refers to many of the Jews that come. I don't know if those are the same.
I think that is the same group.
Oh, okay.
People.
So these are the mourners. They're not really the
well,
general.
Well, there's questioners. There certainly were questioners there, though, right? Because of how they questioned down below. You're right there. But whether or not they're the antagonists, well, they become antagonistic, though.
Yeah.
I think it goes. And Jesus is upset here because he is the life of the world, and they're so stupid, and they're kind of asking these dumb questions. And I love this poem, this part about that all the dead might be rushing back from the section of the tomb.
Yeah.
You know, that really hits because one of the things about Jesus is he never gets within 5 feet of the dead body that doesn't rise, and. And it's just, the scriptures just sort of scream that this is life in the world. You know, this is new life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a cool idea it's a cool idea I've never thought of before, that he's kind of opening up death, and all death might come through this opening that he's creating,
And in a real sense, that's exactly what happens.
Yeah. That there's this huge amount of power.
Yeah.
And also that then it goes back to this human versus divine thing, that he knows he can do it, but he's not positive he can control it, right? Mm-hmm. That, like, he can open it up, but, like, is he going to be able to just get the guy that he wants and everybody else gets to down?
He's almost done it himself, too.
Yeah.
So he wants to prove to himself as well as other people.
He can do it, right?
That's a cool concept.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much reluctance in this, too.
There's so much what?
Reluctance.
Oh, reluctance. Yes, great.
But, you know, he instructs coarsely, you know, that, you know, his voice cracks because he's not quite sure he wants to do it. And that it's unallowed, that he's, he never says it, but that he's worried that maybe this isn't the right use of this power.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
yep.
That's not
Oh, and the heavily, so heavily lifted his hand, and the other raised itself this slowly with this much weight, and there's this, ugh, I don't really want to have to do this. And
that's sort of, that's a great moment to bring up, because it's sort of the biggest, the longest kind of image in the whole poem is this, is just his hand raising up. And just in that image, right, we get the hand is also claw, right? So it's again that, this battling between human and divine, and is this like, is this a miracle or is this a violation? Is it a hand or is it a claw? You know, which is it going to be? And the heavily, you know, it seems like it should be so sort of easy and fun or something.
It's almost like he's taking that instead of, you know, this hand, it's almost like he's retracting his, like, not wanting to do it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, in an earlier part, he also says that he thought it a monstrous and appalling, frivolous experiment. Like, that, as far as the idea of he's not really sure how much power this is or if he can control it, I mean, he calls it an experiment.
Yeah, and the word, and when you both put, like, monster and experiment together in the same, like, line, there's, like, these images of Frankenstein, like, coming back to life that certainly has...
But then he also says it's frivolous. Like, why do I have to show this? Why are they, I mean, shouldn't they just believe that I feel like I don't need to show this kind of thing?
Right.
So frustration.
Frustration.
Well, there's that frustration in the verse also. I mean,
yeah.
Where he says, I mean, he's almost, he protests too muchly when he says, I knew that you always hear me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here. Well, you know, so that they may believe that you sent me. Well, it's sort of like, I wouldn't do this.
Right.
You know, it's not. It wouldn't. It's about me. I wouldn't do this. But for them. Yeah. So you know, there is that. I think that's where Rilke takes that.
It's fleshed out a little bit, but we have it certainly.
Nice metaphor.
Yeah. Fleshed. what was I?
But that's not in this poem. I mean, well, is that he supposed to be capitalized in the middle of the poem?
That is a great question. It brings us to another. Before we're going to go, we're going to go to that in just 1 second. Before we go to that, I want to just point your attention to this. The right kind in the middle, the argument against their prized distinctions. What are, we sort of have named some over here. What are the prized distinctions? What are the sort of opposites that are going on in this poem?
Death and life.
Death and life, that's the biggest one, right? Yep. Death, life. I guess life would be the here, there, right? And some of these are certainly there too, especially the human and divine, I think is Jesus' humanity versus his divinity. Anything else that people?
Belief and disbelief.
Belief and disbelief, great. I'm just rewriting. Okay, so one way... to sort of look at the poem, I think.
There's another one.
Oh, yeah, go
on. Seeing and not seeing.
Seeing and not seeing, great.
That he was enmity in every limb. I mean, that he was the problem. That's one of the distinctions, too. That, I mean, they want to be stoning.
Mm-hmm.
So, as trouble.
So sort of, yeah, is well, kind of almost goes back to this one. Is this going to be a miracle, or is this going to bring harm upon everybody that's there, these two things.
Is it enmity, hatred?
Hatred, yeah.
So, I mean, that just strikes me as very odd, like he was hatred in every man.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be about his love for...
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And it's also in the same sort of phrasing, although I guess it's questionable of their prized distinctions, but I don't really know if that's part of the...
I think it is. I think one of their prized distinctions is that this guy, they hate this guy. They just don't try to stone him. They hate him. You don't stone somebody you like.
Right, but those are the stoners. I think a lot of times the... You've learned nothing in this class. Yeah, I think he's angry at the crowd as much as he is at the stoners. I mean, I think he... You know, Mary, Martha, the disciples, all of them. I mean, I think he's mad that he has to prove this to them. That his friend has had to die so that he can prove to these people who just do not seem to get it that he has this power.
I mean, could you also... I'm just saying this is... Their prize distinctions is death and life. They think they understand what life and death is all about, but they don't. They're here and there, and that he was enmity in every limb.
That's how I read it too. That he was.
Yeah, I mean that's the way they're looking at him. And that's why he's angry.
I didn't read it that way. There's a comment here and there, and then I read it that he was enmity in every limb when he instructed Horsley to lift the stone.
But that line refers to the one said that. Yeah.
Well, he was feeling that in his body, and which is why he.
His anger. His anger caused him to say, "Lift the stone."
The physical manifestation of his anger is just beginning right there at that point,
right?
Mm-hmm. Rather than just the frustration before that.
Yeah. Though I think David's point. I mean, with the great thing about poems is that because they're broken up by lines and not sentences, the line can stand on its own, or we can tie it into the next phrase. So both can always be true. But to get back to the he, which is where we started with all of this, so Jesus is mad about these prized distinctions, and you know that we want to distinguish life from death. And so one way to sort of examine the poem is, where are moments where those distinctions are being lifted up, where we're made to remember life, death, this, that, the separation between the things? And what are ways in which Rilke blurs those distinctions so that it becomes unclear to us as readers what is what? And so that in that way, we're made to experience the line in between these things, the ambiguity. And I think one way is the he, because I think the reason that he is capitalized there is because that's the only sentence where we get to the he referring to Lazarus and the he referring to Jesus in the same line, because the he lay in there for 4 days, but he... So it's just, I think in that line, it's just for clarity to sort of separate. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a great point that we don't get Jesus capitalized throughout, and that our only... I mean, do we get... I don't think we hear the name Jesus anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
Life
we get,
is capitalized in the last one.
Yeah, that's interesting too.
Life,
yes. Yes, and where do we get life in the Bible story?
This one.
We get the mention of life, right. When does life come up?
I am
the life, right? But is he the life in this one? And this becomes a question, right? The inexact, vague life again accepted? Is that Jesus, or is life something separate from Jesus?
It's a weird last line.
It's a really weird last line.
And I only took German for a few years in college, but in German, all nouns are capitalized.
Okay.
So that's interesting, the translator...
Well, let me... Here, you look at this.
But I really don't know anything about German. So I was... That's
well,
just
it's... Yeah, no, I think you're right.
L-E-D-E-N.
Well, is it air? The E-R? Doch air?
Did you get Michael Pollard?
Yeah. I'm trying to see if there's places in here where it's not. No, it's sometimes not.
Which only proves that I know nothing about it.
No. I think you do. No, I think you do, because all of the other nouns are capitalized.
Okay.
It's just like... Let's see if I'm doing this right. Like here, it's... it's not. Yeah. But then here it is.
Yeah,
right.
Well, no, I don't know which ones should be in which ones.
No, I mean, I think he. I mean, it's very possible Rilke's purposefully screwing with this.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to think that that was a technique being used here, though.
Yeah.
A lack of German. Okay, so that is one way that we're feeling that ambiguity with the he being capitalized versus not being capitalized, because that's also the border between human and divine, right, starts to not feel quite as strong if we're not capitalizing Jesus's he and him, right? He's starting to look a lot on the page, a lot more like Bob or Joe would if we were talking about them, right? Or Lazarus. Okay, so what else? What anything else before?
The one witnessed.
Yes. Okay, so the last.
Who's the one?
Yes.
And one, sorry, and one. And so it could be like...
Who could it be? Who could the one be?
People?
People? Could be the crowd? Who else?
Himself.
Could be, wait, who's himself?
What? Jesus.
Jesus, right? Yep.
Could be Lazarus.
Though, how is Lazarus referred to?
He's
the
crooked
shape.
He's
crooked. Larva-like. He's the thing, and he's it.
Never has a name.
Right? So we get Lazarus is the thing, and it, and larva, and crooked, and... But what do words like thing and it do in terms of dissolving this kind of stuff?
Impersonal.
Yeah, impersonal and...
Yeah.
Right. Right. I mean, is this a human being again yet, or is it a dead thing, you know, that's... It doesn't have soul.
It's
or,
like the nature of things. It's like, it's not naturally... He, I mean, he has a life, but it's like artificial, sort of.
Yeah, like, is this actual real? Do we accept him as a living, breathing human again, or is it an it still?
It's kind of like that Frankenstein imagery about the experiment and stuff, the way it's crooked and marbled.
Yeah, it's not pretty. I mean,
the whole thing starts to sound kind of like that whole suction thing at the end. It sounded like one of those, like, Star Wars or one of those movies where...
What?
You know, those, well, you know, they're always being sucked into
yeah.
the whole thing. Yeah, like,
I thought of, what was that?
You know, sci-fi.
Was that Poltergeist with the garden and all those...
It's
all
a lot of them, yeah.
Came up out of the
yeah,
garden.
It's a lot of movies.
Spirits, yeah.
It's interesting to compare to the Bible because it seems in the Bible that he's raising Lazarus because he's his friend, mm-hmm. but it doesn't talk anything about the
yeah,
connection
that's
home. Yeah. It's like he uses Lazarus as this proof thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Totally uses
it. Yeah. Well, and as far as the one that is witnessing, it's almost like all he needed was that one witness, and it's not even that important that it's defined, but because it's about this proof, all he needed was that witness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yep. And I want to throw, too, that I think that the one, I mean, bear with me here for a second, could be the reader, too. That suddenly we've gone from a crowd to, I mean, certainly we know there's more people around. There's not just one.
Mm-hmm.
So who is the one that gets to see it? Well, at some level, we're the one that's getting to see it right now. So, that's maybe more of a stretch than people want to go, but I think... At some level, this use of one at the end is an attempt to totally dissolve a lot of stuff between who's the one who's dead and writhing up larva, like who's the one who's saving, who's the one who's been saved, where are we in all of this, who's actually witnessing, where are the other people? I mean, it just, everything kind of collapses and nothing's quite, the distinctions aren't quite so steady anymore. Yeah?
You know, it's interesting. I know enough German about that. The word for one here, they could be, it's the pronoun one, which is man, but it could have been, you could have just as easily said man, which is capital M-A-N-M, right? Which means human being.
Oh.
So you use little man, which is the pronoun version, versus uh-huh. the human version. So that may be... That
so it's
may
like
be,
a new witness. It's like
huh?
one and,
right.
and a human and a human witness. Human witness, sort of?
Well, if it had been man, M-A-N-N, it would have been, and a human witness.
Mm-hmm.
As the use of man in this version, which is just M-A-N, it just means one witness, the pronoun,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a pronoun. It's the less
you know.
Uh-huh.
It's a less personalized version. Yeah. So it reinforces what you're saying, basically.
Okay. Well, good. It's always nice.
So it wouldn't be the crowd then.
No.
The crowd would be the capital.
Well, no. It could. The point is that looking, it's ambiguous. Rookie, you know, decided to use the less human, less personalized, the more deep personalized version than he could have, is all.
He chose not to be clear.
He chose not to be clear, and he chose to be less personal.
Okay. More distance.
More distance.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is that last line a victim of translation, or is that?
Yeah. No. That's the exact the translation is right.
The exact date, line again, the last line of the poem. Is that the?
I don't understand.
Well, the inexact vague life. I know enough German to know that das ungenau vage Leben is inexact vague life. But then, as wieder mit in Kauf, it means again accepted. That there's a weird translation there because Kauf is a noun, and that I don't know the meaning of. So it's a little.
Maybe
the translator because Kauf as wieder mit, you know, is I believe
so
that.
What are they accepting? I mean, what's being accepted?
What's it? Yeah, well, that's what I think we need to. We need to get something what Kauf means because that's something's myth. Something's.
Well, I do. I will say in defense of the translation that one of my teachers who speaks German fluently and has done lots of translating herself says that this guy is the best translator of all time. And obviously, sometimes the exact translation is not always the one that will communicate the
most. Because there may be a meaning to Kauf that goes beyond what English.
Right.
And I don't think a translator would come up with this bizarre of a last name.
That would be intentional.
Right.
Now, see, I can't tell if I'm putting my reading of mind poetry on the rope, because Rilke didn't often play with punctuation like this. But there's definitely
there's punctuation.
The exact vague life again accepted, and it's run on. Mm-hmm. And if he was more modern, I would have said that he's trying to get across this, like, you know, urgent, like, frustrated, kind of just take it. Like, here it is again. We don't know really what it is.
Exactly.
Here it is. But is he doing that? I mean, it doesn't seem...
I think Rilke is brilliant enough that I wouldn't really put things past him.
I'm not putting him on that
box.
So what you're saying that there's not a punctuation between life and an accepted, but that the way to read it would be, presumably, one witnessed the inexact vague life again.
Accepted.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Wow, that is totally
because the poem is about accepting
I've never read it like that.
Today about the human condition in literature, like if you leave it up to like the reader's interpretation of it, like it could be either ways.
Yeah.
Either way.
Yep. That's great though. I never even.
But just accept it sounds so vernacular. It's hard to imagine that that's what
it's
really not very poetic.
No.
Right.
But, you know, there you go. Like I said, it works for us.
It's still the last two words of the poem. So even if we're not, even if that wasn't exactly how he meant it, he's still landing us on accept it. Like,
well, it's sort of similar to what Jesus said to Martha in the marriage.
Yeah.
Accept it. Accept
it.
It.
Deal
with it.
So what you need to find out is, does mit in Kauf, which is what accepted is mit in Kauf an idiom for accepted?
Okay.
That's what that would
answer the question.
That would answer the question. So
Nelly.
Oh, yeah, we should ask her.
Okay. Right. but now, okay, so there's like, we can keep staying with this poem because there's so much in it. But I think we have the main sort of, I encourage you to just like keep going back and looking at it, because there's a lot, if you just start at the beginning looking for questions of ambiguity, I mean, just for instance, the first line, it's pretty unclear who's even speaking the poem. Mm-hmm. It for, I mean, yes, it was necessary for this common sort since they required signs, signs that screamed, could from our Bible reading here be Jesus, right? And then the next line we understand that it's not. But I'm just saying there's lots of ways in this poem that he's harping on these ambiguities, and then there's some moments where he's like, no, like, let's remember the distinctions. It's cool that way. But I do want to at least, I know we don't have much time, so what we're going to do is read through this other poem, which is long, we'll take turns, and just kind of initial comments. We won't have time to really discuss it, but I think it's a pretty cool poem. I'm just going to warn you before we start reading it that she tends to have, I mean, her sort of signature thing is these really long lines that get, especially in the middle, they start to get really convoluted, and you just cannot even wrap your head around where she started and where she ended up, and I think that's part of kind of what's going on. But as you read, if you find yourself not having any idea where the what the subject of the thing actually was and what happened to it, that's
very German.
Part of it. She's not German.
I know, but that's
oh.
Very...
Oh, we can't. Okay, I'll read the first stanza, then we'll go this way. Decision. Really, Lazarus decided himself that he didn't like it. Death left little to his imagination. Mostly he was numb and having to concentrate tremendously just to believe in toes, shins. But he was adamant about it. Missing color, his dead eyes failed to interpret being unable to commute the stay of darkness. He did not relent until the bones trembled
so vigorously with decision that the Lord perceived movement that opposed his own. Defiance is not necessarily unattractive. On that day, it was welcome diversion. Mist had situated itself in balance and was a thin layer of peace, a weak hymen that no one, save Lazarus, rushed to violate. Impressed, the Lord called him, granted permission for rebellion.
But for a minute stopped as Lazarus reconsidered just whether or not the need had really been his own. His decision was weakened by the call and by death's apparent rejection of him. Wasn't he good enough for darkness in which he was beggar, totally dependent on dark Congress? Just what did he own in the chamber that was somewhat reticent about wanting him, not pushing toward him as he pushed it away? Had death been holding its breath, hoping this man would get the hint and leave as quietly and quickly as he had arrived so that death could feel freer without this inadequate presence that refused to melt and relinquish authority that populated the cavern with thoughts drifting like mermaids and all their vanity and temptation, convinced that he could not die well.
Lazarus went about his departure wondering how he could explain the lack of loveliness when only he was there. The lack of fire, when he was sure the same heart was helping him now to rise and take steps, to prove that this is truly a hospitable world whose fruits are for him, whose textures are for his pleasure, and who does not mind that he invents the language of mastery, that he aspires, challenges, does not notice the tomb shrink like a postpartum uterus, but the difficulty of its accommodating him was all in his mind that itself entombs myriad good ideas he has wasted to include that he's on top of the world.
He must step lightly on this road he travels, renewed, confident, repressing the truth that he brings to death nothing new. One hard step and he'll sink, for there are pockets in the earth, envelopes, untrustworthy patches into which he could slip, and rescue may not repeat. Willpower is unreliable. This lean determination will grow flabby, and next time won't have the strength of mind over matter. The matter of his body will acquire a heaviness active tissue lacks, an immobility and fixed stance a living mind resists, changing and fickle in its causes and beliefs. And the Lord, who truly loves this man, may not call him again.
No matter that Lazarus becomes the ultimate supplicant, that his prayer is moist with nether weather or so poignant they may remain in the sky, additional bright celestial hopelessness to inspire, though they merely reflect and do not generate their light. No matter for the radiance, it's but a promise, and some dates and loves, even first loves, don't call you anymore. Leave you high and dry, and there you are alone with your broken body begging. Here, take, eat, consume, digest, and I'll be your little bit of excrement, devoted little bit of shit.
I need to go over there in a couple minutes, but I think that brings maybe just for like maybe 3 minutes we could talk about, you're saying it's great to hear these parables and these stories from these different perspectives, and I totally agree, and I always struggle with, I mean, even more than Rilke, I think that Moss's version of Lazarus is, I mean, it's saying some pretty strong things, and especially, I mean, I think at the end it goes into what is it like to have a relationship with Jesus? What might that relationship have actually been like? And what is the difference between being a supplicant and a devoted bit of shit, you know? And like, and it really gets into the Last Supper and taking flesh into the body and the idea that, I mean, we take communion, but the reality is that whatever we put into our body leaves our body too. And what is Jesus, you know, like, I mean, which is a very physical and visceral way of dealing with that, but it's a real one. So with such a strong interpretation of, as this one, what do we do with it when we go back to the story? How do we use it or not use it? What do you guys?
Well, I was sitting here looking at, you know, the first set of verses there where, I mean, Jesus is really using Lazarus, mm-hmm. right? And from Lazarus' perspective, it's like, I didn't, you know, I'm being used. I am being used.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you could have saved me, but you didn't. But then when you heard about me, you could have saved me. But you waited 2 days.
Right.
You know, because it's not about me. Yeah. It's about you proving what you need to prove to the crowds or the whoever. And it's, you know, the fact that this was written by an African-American, mm-hmm. You know, and the way in which Christianity has used, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, slave, you know, blacks. I saw that parallel also. It's like, I'm feeling used.
So in some ways, so for you, in terms of how to reinterpret the story,
right.
as you read again, you come to that line, and the word used takes on, it's almost like contained in that
right.
word.
And the last part is that, I think part of Jesus's, you know, to give Jesus credit, I think part of his pain and his suffering, his weeping, is that he's using his friend in this
way. So that the weeping, so it's in some ways it's an interpretation of the weeping, which is kind of the mystery.
And the disturbance. And
it's
the disturbance.
Mystery, right. But those feelings, as we discussed in the beginning, are sort of the mystery gestures. Why is he doing that? And so it's
one
kind
explanation
of
is that
guilt, right?
Yeah, guilt, basically. I'm using my friend. I'm using a human being in a way for basically to do a little parlor trick.
Yep.
So that these people who don't believe unless I do parlor tricks
will be inspired.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, somebody say something.
Oh, I was just stretching, but I can say something. It makes me, and this is kind of a simple thing, and I actually don't know what happens after the story, this part of the story in the Bible ends, but what happens to Lazarus? They ever talk about Lazarus after?
There's something.
Like,
there's
some
after
there's
a
after
there.
He comes to visit him again, but he's pretty well.
Yeah, when they raised from the dead, they had dinner, Martha served, and Lazarus one of those at the table with him.
Does it ever explain Lazarus' point of view at all?
I don't know, and I don't think so. Okay, he's saying no, he knows more than I do. Unfortunately, I can't answer that as much. Okay, so I would love to keep talking about this forever, because I love these poems, and you guys have been awesome. Thank you so much for coming, and feel free to keep these if you want. Otherwise, I can set them here, and I will dispose of them.